daughter's arrival. Jean said that 50 children would not be able to wear all the clothes and play with all those toys, but Blanca's only amusement was to scour the paltry downtown stores where she purchased every pink baby item she could find. She spent her days embroidering infants' dresses, knitting woolen booties, decorating little baskets, arranging the stacks of tiny blouses, bibs, and diapers, and ironing the sheets she had embroidered. After the siesta, she would write her mother, and sometimes her brother Jaime. And when the sun began to set and the air grew cooler, she would go for a walk around the property to shake the numbness from her legs. In the evening, she joined her husband in the enormous dining room, whose bordello lighting was supplied by the ceramic Negroes standing in the corners. They sat at opposite ends of the table, which was set with a long tablecloth, a full service of china and glassware, and adorned with artificial flowers, because no real ones grew in that inhospitable region. They were always attended by the same impassive, silent Indian, who constantly sucked a great ball of coca leaves that was his chief sustenance. He was a peculiar servant and had no specific duties within the domestic hierarchy. Waiting on the table was certainly not his forte. He had still to master platters and serving implements and would fling the food down however he could. One time, Blanca had to remind him, please, not to grab the potatoes with his hand and put them on her plate. But Jean de Satigny held him in mysterious regard and was training him to be his assistant in the laboratory. If he can't talk like a human being, how do you expect him to take pictures? Blanca observed when Jean told her his plan. This was the Indian Blanca thought she had seen in Louis XV heels. Her first months as a wife were peaceful and boring. Blanca's natural tendency to isolation and solitude became accentuated. Since she refused to partake of the local social life, Jean de Satigny was forced to go alone to the numerous events to which they were invited. Later, returning home, he regaled Blanca with accounts of the vulgarity of these stale, out-of-date families whose daughters were still chaperoned and whose gentlemen wore scapulars. Blanca led the idle life that was her true vocation, while her husband gave himself to those small pleasures that only money can buy and that he had denied himself for such a long time. Every night, he went to the casino. His wife calculated that he must be losing huge sums of money, because at the end of the month, there was invariably a long line of creditors at their door. Jean had very strange ideas about their household finances. He bought himself the most up-to-date automobile, with leopard skin upholstery and golden fittings worthy of an Arab prince, the largest, most ostentatious car ever seen in those parts. He established a network of mysterious contacts that enabled him to buy antiques, particularly Baroque French porcelain, for which he had a weakness. He also imported crates of fine liqueurs that were cleared through customs without incident. His contraband entered the house through the service door and exited through the front door on its way to other destinations, where Jean consumed it in secret revels or sold it at exorbitant prices. They never invited people to their house, and within weeks the ladies of the neighborhood had stopped inviting Blanca. Rumor had it she was proud, arrogant, and ill, which only increased the general sympathy for the Count, who gained a reputation as a patient, long-suffering husband. Blanca got along well with him. The only times they argued were when she tried to look into their finances. She could not understand how Jean could buy porcelain and drive that spotted car when he did not have enough money to pay the Chinese man in the general store or the salaries of their numerous servants. Jean refused to discuss the matter, on the assumption that it was a man's business and that she had no need to fill her sparrow's brain with problems she could not understand. Blanca supposed that Jean de Satigny's account with Esteban Trueba gave him unlimited amounts of money, and since it was impossible to reach an understanding with him, she ended up pretending to be ignorant of such matters. In this house, embedded in sand and inhabited by strange Indians who seemed to exist in some other dimension, she vegetated like a flower from another climate, frequently coming across certain small details that made her question her own sanity. Reality seemed blurred to her, as if the same implacable sun that erased all colors had also deformed the world around her, transforming even people into silent shadows. In the soporific heat of those months, Blanca, protected by the creature that was growing inside her, forgot about the magnitude of her disgrace. She stopped thinking about Pedro Tercero Garcia with the terrible urgency she had felt before, and took refuge in the sweet, faded memories she could always conjure up at will. Her sensuality was dormant, and on the rare occasions when she brooded over her unfortunate fate, she had a pleasant vision of herself floating in a nebula, without suffering or joy, far away from the cruelties of life, with her daughter as her sole companion. She came to believe that she had lost her capacity to love, and that the burning desire of her flesh had been quelled forever. She spent interminable hours staring at the pallid landscape that stretched out before her window. The house was on the very edge of the city, and was ringed by a few rickety trees that had managed to withstand the onslaught of the desert. To the north, the wind had destroyed all vegetation, and she could see the immense plains of dunes and distant hills quivering in the sweltering light. During the day, she was overcome by the suffocation of that leaden sun, and at night she shivered in her bed, protecting herself from chills with hot water bottles and woolen shawls. She stared at the limpid, naked sky looking for traces of a cloud, hoping that sooner or later a drop of rain would fall to break the unbearable harshness of that lunar valley. The months rolled by unchanging, with no other distraction than her mother's letters, which told of her father's political campaign, Nicolás's madness, and the excesses of Jaime, who lived like a priest but walked around with lovesick eyes. In one of her letters, Clara suggested that to keep her hands busy, she go back to making creches. She tried. She ordered some of the special clay she had used at Tres Marias, set up a studio in the back of the kitchen, and had a couple of Indians build her an oven for firing her pieces. But Jean de Satigny made fun of her artistic impulse, saying that if she wanted to do something with her hands, she would be better off knitting booties and learning to make pastry. She finally abandoned her work, not so much because of her husband's sarcasm, but because it seemed impossible to compete with the ancient pottery of the Indians. Jean had organized his business with the same tenacity he had formerly brought to the idea of the chinchillas, but this time with more success. Aside from a German priest who had spent 30 years ranging across the area, digging up the Inca past, no one else had bothered with those relics, since they were thought to be of little or no value. The government forbade any trafficking in Indian antiquities and had given the priest a general concession, authorizing him to catalog whatever he found and hand it over to the museum. Jean saw them for the first time in the dusty display cases of the museum. He spent 2 days with the German. Happy, after all these years, to discover someone interested in his work, the priest had no misgivings about revealing his vast knowledge. Thus, Jean learned how to determine the exact amount of time the relics had lain in the ground, how to differentiate the various styles and epochs, and how to locate burial grounds in the desert by means of signs invisible to civilized eyes. Finally, he decided that even if these shards lacked the golden splendor of Egyptian tombs, they nonetheless had a certain historical value. Once he obtained all the information that he needed, he organized teams of Indians to dig up whatever might have escaped the priest's zealous archaeological notice. Magnificent ceramic jars, green with the patina of time, began to arrive at his house, disguised in Indians' bundles and llama saddlebags, quickly filling the secret places that had been set aside for them. Blanca watched them piling up in the rooms and was astonished by their shapes. She held them in her hands, caressing them as if hypnotized, and whenever they were wrapped in straw and paper to be shipped to far-off unknown destinations, she was grief-stricken. This pottery was just too beautiful. She felt that the monsters from her creches did not belong under the same roof. For this reason, more than for any other, she abandoned her workshop. The business of the Indian excavations was completely secret, since they were part of the historical heritage of the nation. Various teams of Indians who had slipped across the twisted passes of the border undetected were working for Jean de Satigny. They had no documents that proved they were human beings, and they were silent, stubborn, and inscrutable. Every time Blanca asked where these people who would suddenly appear in her courtyard came from, she was told they were cousins of the servant who waited on them in the dining room. And it was true. They all looked alike. They did not stay long, however. Most of the time, they were in the desert, with only a shovel to dig the sand and a wad of coca in their mouths to keep them alive. Occasionally, they were fortunate enough to unearth the half-buried remains of an Incan village, and in no time at all, the house would fill with all the objects they had stolen from the site. The search, transport, and selling of this merchandise was conducted in such a cautious fashion that Blanca had no doubt that there was something highly illegal behind her husband's activities. Jean explained to her that the government was very interested in filthy pots and scrawny necklaces from the desert, and that in order to avoid the endless paperwork required by the official bureaucracy, he preferred to negotiate matters on his own. He shipped his items in boxes sealed with Apple labels, thanks to the interested cooperation of certain customs inspectors. None of this worried Blanca very much. The only thing that truly distressed her were the mummies. She was well acquainted with the dead, having spent much of her life in contact with them by means of her mother's three-legged table. She was used to seeing their transparent silhouettes gliding down the hallways of her parents' house, making noise in the wardrobes, and appearing in people's dreams to predict calamities or lottery prizes. But the mummies were another matter. Those shrunken beings wrapped in rags that were decaying into dusty threads, with their wasted yellow heads, their wrinkled hands, their sewn eyelids, the sparse hairs on their napes, their eternal, terrible, lipless smiles, their rancid odor, and that sad, impoverished aura of ancient corpses made her sick in her soul. They were very rare. Only once in a great while did the Indians arrive with one in tow. Slow and immutable, they appeared at the door carrying an enormous vessel sealed with clay. Jean would carefully remove the lid in a room with all its doors and windows closed so that the first breath of air did not turn it to dust. Inside its jar, shrunken into a fetal position, wrapped in tatters and accompanied by its wretched necklaces of teeth and a handful of rag dolls, the mummy looked like the pit of some exotic fruit. They were far more highly prized than any other objects that were brought out of the tombs, because private collectors and a few foreign museums paid very handsomely for them. Blanca wondered what sort of people collected the dead and where they put them. She could not imagine a mummy as part of the decoration in a drawing room, but Jean de Satigny told her that, displayed in a glass urn, they were even more valuable to European millionaires than works of art. It was not easy to get mummies onto the market, let alone through customs, which meant that there were times when they remained in the house for several weeks, awaiting their turn to embark on the long trip abroad. Blanca dreamt about them. She also had hallucinations, imagining that they were walking down the halls on tiptoe, tiny, cunning, furtive gnomes. She would close her bedroom door and put her head under the blankets, and there she would remain for hours at a time, trembling, praying, and calling for her mother with the power of thought. She told Clara about it in her letters, and her mother replied that there was no reason to fear the dead, only the living, because despite their bad reputation, there was no evidence that mummies had ever attacked anyone. If anything, they were naturally timid. Emboldened by her mother's advice, Blanca decided to spy on them. She waited for them silently, watching through the half-open doorway of her bedroom. It was not long before she was convinced that they were walking up and down in the house, dragging their tiny feet across the carpets, whispering like schoolchildren, pushing and shoving their way in little groups of two and three, always moving toward the dark room of Jean de Satigny. At times she thought she heard distant, otherworldly moans, and she would fall prey to uncontrollable fits of terror, shouting for her husband, but no one came, and she was too afraid to walk to the other side of the house to look for him. With the first rays of sunlight, Blanca would regain her good sense and control of her nerves. She realized that the nighttime anxiety was the fruit of the feverish imagination she had inherited from her mother. And this thought would console her until darkness began to fall again, and the cycle of dread resumed. One day, she simply could not stand the rising tension as night drew near, and she decided to tell Jean about the mummies. They were having dinner, when she told him about their nightly promenades, their whispers, and their suffocated cries, Jean de Satigny was rooted to his chair, his fork frozen in midair, and his mouth locked open. The Indian who was just entering the dining room with a serving tray stumbled, and the roast chicken rolled under a chair. Jean employed all his charm, firmness, and reason to convince her that her nerves were playing tricks on her, and that none of what she thought was really happening, that it was all the product of her unbridled fantasy. Blanca pretended to accept his explanation, but her husband's vehemence struck her as suspicious, since he normally paid no attention to her problems. So did the servant's face, which, with its popped-out eyes, had finally lost the impassive gaze of an Incan idol. She decided to embark on an investigation of the nomadic mummies. That night, she excused herself early after telling her husband that she was going to take a tranquilizer to be sure of falling asleep. But instead, she drank a large cup of black coffee and stationed herself behind her door, prepared to spend many hours waiting. She heard the first footsteps close to midnight. She opened the door with the utmost caution and stuck her head out just as a tiny, crouched figure was moving down the hall. This time, she was positive she had not dreamt it. But because of the weight of her unborn child, it took her almost a minute to reach the corridor. It was a chilly night, and the desert breeze was blowing, making the old wooden ceilings creak and the curtains swell like black sails on the high seas. Ever since she was little, when she listened to Nana's stories of the boogeyman down in the kitchen, she had feared the dark. But now she did not dare turn on the lights, or she would frighten the tiny mummies during their erratic strolls. Suddenly, a hoarse, muffled sound broke the thick silence of the night, as if it was coming from the bottom of a coffin, or so Blanca thought. She was beginning to fall victim to a morbid fascination with things from beyond the grave. She stopped in her tracks, her heart in her mouth, but a second moan pulled her to her senses, giving her the strength to continue toward Jean de Satigny's laboratory door. She tried to open it, but it was locked. She pressed her face to the door. It was then that she clearly heard the moans, suffocated cries, and laughter, and no longer doubted that something was going on with the mummies. She returned to her room, relieved to know that her nerves were not failing her, but that something atrocious was going on in her husband's secret den. The next day, Blanca waited for Jean de Satigny to finish his meticulous toilette, eat his usual parsimonious breakfast, read his newspaper cover to cover, and finally leave on his morning walk, letting nothing in her placid, expectant mother's countenance betray her fierce determination. When Jean went out, she called the high-heeled Indian and for the first time gave him an order. Go to the city and buy me some candied papaya, she told him brusquely. The Indian set off at the slow trot typical of his race, and she remained in the house with the other servants, whom she feared far less than that strange individual with the courtly inclinations. Since she estimated that she had a couple of hours before he returned, she decided not to be too hasty and to proceed calmly. She was determined to clear up the mystery of the furtive mummies, convinced that in daylight the mummies would be in no mood for clowning. She went to the dark room, hoping that the door would be open, but it was locked as always. She tried all the keys on her ring, but none of them worked. Then she took the biggest knife from the kitchen, slipped it into the door jamb, and forced it until the dried-out wood splintered and came out in fragments. Thus she managed to pry the lock loose from the frame and open the door. The damage to the door was impossible to hide, and she realized that when her husband saw it, she would have to give some rational explanation. But she consoled herself with the argument that as mistress of the house, she had a right to know what was going on beneath her roof. Despite her common sense, which had withstood more than 20 years' worth of the three-legged table and her mother's prognostications, she was trembling as she crossed the threshold of the dark room. She groped for the light switch and flicked it on. She found herself in a spacious room with black walls and thick black curtains on the windows, through which not even a feeble ray of sunlight filtered. The floor was covered with dark, thick rugs. Everywhere were the bulbs, lamps, and screens she had first seen Jean use at old Pedro Garcia's funeral, when he had been so enamored of photographing the living and the dead that he made everyone uneasy, and the peasants ended up kicking his photographic plates to the ground. She looked around in bewilderment. She was standing in the middle of the strangest scene. She continued forward, sidestepping open trunks that held plumed garments from every period, curled wigs, and ostentatious hats. She stopped before a golden trapeze, suspended from the ceiling, on which hung a disjointed life-size puppet. In a corner, she saw a stuffed llama. On the tables were bottles filled with amber-colored liquids, and on the floor, the skins of exotic animals. But what most surprised her were the photographs. She stood open-mouthed before them. The walls of Jean de Satigny's studio were covered with distressing erotic scenes that revealed her husband's hidden character. Blanca was slow to react, and it was a while before she realized what she saw, because she had no experience in such matters. Pleasure to her was the final precious stage of the long road she had traveled with Pedro III, on which she had moved unhurried and in good spirits, framed by the forests, the wheat fields, the river, and the immense sky, in the silence of the countryside. She had never felt the uncertainties of adolescence, while her classmates secretly read forbidden romances about passionate suitors and virgins aching to be so no longer. She sat in the shade of the plum trees in the convent courtyard, closed her eyes, and summoned with complete precision the magnificent vision of Pedro III Garcia holding her in his arms, stroking and kissing her, and eliciting from her the same profound harmony he drew from his guitar. Her instincts were satisfied as soon as they were awakened, and she had never imagined that passion could take other forms. These chaotic, tormented scenes were 1,000 times more disconcerting than the scandalous mummies she had expected to find. She recognized the faces of the household servants. There was the entire Incan court, as naked as God had put them on this earth, or barely clad in theatrical costumes. She saw the fathomless abyss between the thighs of the cook, the stuffed llama riding atop the lame servant girl, and the silent servant who waited on her at table, naked as a newborn babe, hairless and short-legged, with his expressionless stone face and his disproportionate erect penis. For an interminable second, Blanca was suspended in her own uncertainty. Then she was overcome with horror. She managed to think clearly. She understood what Jean de Satigny had meant on their wedding night when he explained that he did not feel inclined to married life. She also glimpsed the sinister power of the Indian and the subtle mockery of the servants, and felt herself a prisoner in the anteroom of hell. Just then, the child moved inside her, and she jumped as if an alarm had just been sounded. "My daughter! I have to get out of here!" she cried. Hugging her womb, she ran out of the dark room, crossed the entire house in a flash, and reached the street, where the leaden heat and the ruthless midday sun brought her back to reality. She understood that she would not get very far on foot with her 9-month belly. She returned to her bedroom, took all the money she could find, prepared a bundle containing some of the clothing from the splendid wardrobe she had knit, and left for the station. Seated on the hard wooden bench near the tracks, with her bundle in her lap and her eyes full of fright, Blanca waited hours for the train, praying that the Count, on returning home and discovering the damage to his laboratory door, would not come looking for her and force her to return to the evil kingdom of the Incas. She prayed for the train to be on time for once in its life, so that she might arrive at her parents before the creature that was crushing her insides and kicking at her ribs announced its arrival in the world. She prayed for the strength to endure this 2-day journey, and she prayed that her desire to live would be stronger than this terrible sense of desolation that was beginning to paralyze her. She gritted her teeth and waited. 9. Little Alba. Alba was born feet first, which is a sign of good luck. Her grandmother, Clara, searched her back and found the tiny star-shaped mark that distinguishes those born to true happiness. "There's no need to worry about this little girl. She will be lucky and she will be happy. She will also have a good complexion, because that is inherited. And at my age, I have no wrinkles and have never had a pimple," Clara declared 2 days after the birth. This is why they made no effort to prepare the child for life, since the stars had already conspired to endow her with so many gifts. Her sign was Leo. Her grandmother studied her astrological chart and recorded her destiny in white ink in an album with pages of black paper, in which she also pasted the child's first greenish locks of hair, the fingernails she clipped soon after her birth, and various portraits that allowed one to see her as she was then, an extraordinary tiny creature, almost bald, creased and pale, with no other sign of human intelligence that her sparkling black eyes, which bore an expression of ancient wisdom even when she was in the cradle. They were identical to those of her real father. Her mother wanted to call her Clara, but her grandmother did not believe in repeating names because it created confusion in her notebooks that bore witness to life. They searched for a name in a thesaurus, where they found hers, the last in a chain of luminous words. Years later, Alba tormented herself with the thought that when she had a daughter, there would be no other word with the same meaning to use as a name. But Blanca gave her the idea of using foreign languages, which offer a wide choice. Alba was almost born in a narrow-gauge train at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in the middle of the desert. That would have been fatal to her astrological chart. Fortunately, she managed to restrain herself within her mother for a few more hours and to enter the world in her grandparents' house, on the day, the hour, and in the place most propitious for her horoscope. Her mother arrived at the big house on the corner without advance notice. She was completely disheveled, covered with dust, bleary-eyed, and doubled over from the pain of the contractions with which Alba was pushing her way out. She knocked at the door in desperation, and when it opened, she rushed through, all the way to the sewing room, where Clara was putting the finishing touches on the last exquisite dress for her future granddaughter. There, Blanca collapsed after her long journey, without explaining a thing, for her belly erupted in a long, liquid sigh, and she felt as if all the water in the world were running out between her legs in a violent flush. At the sound of Clara's screams, the servants came running, and so did Jaime, who was always in the house during that time, keeping watch on Amanda. They moved Blanca into Clara's room, and while they were laying her on the bed and pulling off her clothes, the minuscule human form of Alba began to appear. Her uncle Jaime, who had assisted at several births at the clinic, helped her into the world, grasping her firmly by the buttocks with his right hand while the fingers of his left groped in the darkness for the child's neck to remove the umbilical cord, which was strangling her. Meanwhile, drawn by the noise, Amanda ran in and pressed with all her weight on Blanca's belly, while Clara, leaning over her daughter's suffering face, held a tea strainer covered with an ether-soaked rag to her nose. Alba was born quickly. Jaime removed the cord from around her neck, held her upside down, and dangled her in the air, and with two resounding slaps introduced her into the suffering of life and the mechanics of breathing. But Amanda, who had read about the customs of African tribes and preached a return to nature, seized the newborn from his hands and gently placed her on the warm belly of her mother, where she found some consolation for the sadness of being born. Naked and embracing, mother and daughter lay resting while the others cleaned up the afterbirth and bustled about with the new sheets and the first batch of diapers. In the excitement of these first moments, no one noticed the half-open door of the wardrobe, where little Miguel had observed the entire scene, paralyzed with fear, engraving in his mind forever the vision of a huge balloon of veins crowned with an enormous navel, from which that bruised creature emerged, wrapped in a hideous blue membrane. Alba's name was entered in the civil registry and in the books of the parish with her father's French surname, but she never used it because her mother's was much easier to spell. Her grandfather, Esteban Trueba, did not approve of this bad habit. As he said every time he was given the opportunity, he had gone to a lot of trouble to be sure the child would have a known father and respectable name, and would not have to use her mother's, as if she were a child of shame and sin. Nor did he allow anyone to doubt the legitimate paternity of the Count. Against all logic, he continued to hope that sooner or later the quiet, awkward little girl who glided through his house would display the Frenchman's elegant manners and refined charms. Clara made no mention of the matter either, until much later, when she saw the little girl playing among the ruined statues in the garden and realized that she did not resemble anyone in the family, much less Jean de Satigny. "I wonder where she got those old man's eyes," she asked. "They're her father's eyes," Blanca replied absent-mindedly. "Pedro Tercero Garcia, I suppose." "Uh-huh." It was the only time anyone ever mentioned Alba's origin within the family, because, as Clara noted, the issue was irrelevant since Jean de Satigny had disappeared from their life. They never heard a word about him, and no one bothered to investigate his whereabouts, not even to legalize Blanca's status, for she lacked the freedom of an unmarried woman and had all the limitations of a married one, even though she had no husband. Alba never saw a picture of the Count, for her mother did not leave a corner of the house untouched until she had destroyed them all, even those that showed them arm in arm on their wedding day. She had decided to forget the man she had married and act as if he had never existed. She never spoke of him again, nor did she offer any explanation for her flight from the conjugal abode. Clara, who had spent 9 years without speaking, knew the advantages of silence and asked her daughter nothing, joining in her efforts to erase all memory of Jean de Satigny. Alba was told that her father was a distinguished and intelligent aristocrat, who had unfortunately succumbed to fever in the northern desert. This was one of the few lies she had to put up with as a child. In everything else, she was in direct contact with the prosaic truths of life. Her uncle Jaime had taken it upon himself to destroy the myths that children come from under cabbage plants or are brought by stork from Paris. And her uncle Nicolas had demolished those of the three kings, good fairies, and boogeymen. Alba had nightmares in which she saw her father's death. She dreamt of a young, handsome man, dressed all in white, with patent leather shoes and a straw hat, walking across the desert bathed in sunlight. In her dream, the walker slackened his pace, hesitated, went slower and slower, stumbled and fell, picked himself up and stumbled again, burning with the heat, fever, and thirst. He pulled himself along the hot sand on his knees for a time, but in the end, he lay stretched out in the vastness of those pale dunes as birds of prey circled over his inert body. She dreamt about him so many times that years later, it came as a surprise when she was called to the central morgue to identify the body of the man she thought must be her father. By that time, Alba was a bold young woman, much accustomed to adversity, so she went alone. She was met by a white-apron technician who led her down the long corridors of the ancient building to a large, cold room whose walls were painted gray. The man in the white apron opened the door of an immense refrigerator and withdrew a tray on which lay an old, swollen, bluish corpse. Alba examined it carefully, finding no resemblance to the image of her dreams. The man appeared to be an ordinary citizen, perhaps a post office employee. She stared at his hands. They were not those of a refined, intelligent aristocrat, but of a man who has nothing interesting to say. But his identification papers gave irrefutable proof that the sad, blue corpse was Jean de Satigny, who had not died of fever in the golden dunes of a child's nightmare, but of a simple stroke as he crossed the street in his old age. But this all happened much later. When Clara was alive, and Alba was still a child, the big house on the corner was a cloistered world in which she grew up, protected even from her own nightmares. Alba was not yet 2 weeks old when Amanda left the big house on the corner. Amanda had recovered her strength and had no trouble reading the desire in Jaime's heart. She took her little brother by the hand and left exactly as she had arrived, without making noise or promises. The family lost sight of her, and the only one who could have gone to look for her chose not to because he did not wish to hurt his brother. After she left, Jaime drowned his sorrows in study and work. He resumed his old habits, living like a hermit and rarely appearing at the house. He never mentioned the young woman's name and had nothing more to do with his brother. The presence of his granddaughter sweetened Esteban Trueba's character. The change was imperceptible, but Clara noticed it. Slight symptoms gave him away. The sparkle in his eyes when he saw the little girl, the expensive presents he bought her, the anguish he felt if he heard her cry. Still, it was not enough to bring him closer to Blanca. His relationship with his daughter had never been good, and after her unfortunate marriage, it had deteriorated to the point where only the obligatory politeness Clara imposed allowed them to live under the same roof. In those days, almost all the rooms in the Trueba house were filled. The table was always set for the family, the guests, and one extra place for anyone who might arrive unannounced. The main door was left permanently open to allow guests and visitors to come and go, while Senator Trueba attempted to alter his country's destiny. His wife sailed masterfully through the agitated seas of social life and the other, more surprising ones of her spiritual voyage. Age and experience had sharpened Clara's ability to divine the occult and to move objects from afar. An exalted state of mind could easily put her into a trance in which she would move around the room while sitting in a chair, as if there were a hidden motor underneath the cushions. It was also during that time that a starving young artist who had been given lodging in the house out of pity paid for his stay by painting the only extant portrait of Clara. Much later, the impoverished artist was recognized as a master, and today, the painting hangs in a London museum, like so many works of art that left the country when people had to sell their furnishings to feed the victims of persecution. The canvas shows a middle-aged woman dressed in white, with silvery hair and the sweet gaze of a trapeze artist, resting in a rocking chair that hangs suspended just above the floor, floating amidst flowered curtains, a vase flying upside down, and a fat black cat that observes the scene like an important gentleman. Influence of Chagall, according to the catalog, but that is not true. The picture captures precisely the reality the painter witnessed in Clara's house. That was the period when divine good humor and the hidden forces of human nature acted with impunity to provoke a state of emergency and upheaval in the laws of physics and logic. Clara's communication with wandering souls and extraterrestrials was conducted through telepathy, dreams, and the pendulum she used for that purpose, dangling it in the air above an alphabet she had arranged in proper order on the table. The pendulum's autonomous movement pointed to the letters, forming messages in Spanish and Esperanto, which proved that these, and not English, were the only languages of interest to beings from other dimensions, as Clara wrote in letters to the ambassadors of the English-speaking powers. They never answered her, and neither did the various ministers of education, whom she wrote in order to explain her theory that instead of teaching English and French, which were languages for sailors, peddlers, and moneylenders, the schools should insist that all children in the country study Esperanto. Alba's childhood was a mixture of vegetarian diets, Japanese martial arts, Tibetan dance, yogic breathing, relaxation and concentration with Professor Hauser, and many other interesting techniques, not to mention the contribution to her education made by her two uncles and the three enchanting Mora sisters. Her grandmother Clara managed to keep that immense covered wagon of a house rolling with its population of eccentrics, even though she had no domestic talent and disdained the basic operations of arithmetic to the point of forgetting how to add. The daily organization of the household and the keeping of accounts, therefore, fell to Blanca, who divided her time between the job of chief steward of that miniature kingdom and her work at the ceramic studio in the back of the courtyard, the ultimate refuge for her sorrows, where she gave classes for both mongoloids and young ladies and created incredible creches full of monsters which, against all logic, sold like hotcakes. From a tender age, it had been Alba's responsibility to put fresh flowers in the vases. She would open the windows to let in streams of air and light, but the flowers never lasted until nightfall, because Esteban Trueba's thundering voice and slashing cane were even powerful enough to frighten nature. At the sound of his footsteps, household pets scattered and plants withered. Blanca was raising a Brazilian rubber tree, a shy, squalid little bush, whose one attraction was its price. It was sold by the leaf. Whenever Trueba was heard arriving, whoever was closest ran to hide the rubber tree out on the terrace, because as soon as the old man entered the room, the plant lowered its leaves and began to exude a whitish fluid, like tears of milk from its stem. Alba did not go to school. Her grandmother held that anyone as favored by the stars as she was needed only to know how to read and write, and she could learn that at home. Clara was in such a hurry to make her literate that at the age of 5, the little girl was already reading the newspaper over breakfast and discussing the news with her grandfather. At 6, she had discovered the magic books in the enchanted trunks of her legendary great-uncle Marcos and had fully entered the world without return of the imagination. Nor did anyone worry about her health. They did not believe in the benefits of vitamins and thought that vaccinations were for chickens. Besides, her grandmother studied the lines of her hand and said that she was made of iron and was assured of a long life. The only frivolous attention they lavished on her was to comb her hair with bay rum to mitigate the dark green hue it had when she was born. This despite the fact that Senator Trueba thought it should be left that way, since she was the only one who had inherited something from Rosa the Beautiful, even if, unfortunately, it was only the maritime color of her hair. To please him, Alba gave up the bay rum as an adolescent and rinsed her hair with parsley water, which allowed the green to reappear in its full leafiness. The rest of her was tiny and innocuous as opposed to the other women in her family, who were, almost without exception, splendid. In the rare moments of leisure, Blanca had to think about herself and her daughter. She regretted that her child was so silent and solitary, and that she had no playmates her own age. But Alba did not feel the least bit lonely. In fact, there were times when she would have been delighted to escape her grandmother's clairvoyance, her mother's intuition, and the clamor of all the eccentric people who were constantly appearing, disappearing, and reappearing in the big house on the corner. It also worried Blanca that her daughter did not play with dolls. But Clara took her granddaughter's side, arguing that those tiny porcelain corpses with eyes that opened and shut and perverse, pouting mouths were repulsive. She herself constructed shapeless beings made of leftover scraps from the wool she used to knit for the poor. These creatures had no human traits, which made it much easier to cradle them, rock them, bathe them, and then throw them in the garbage. But the child's favorite plaything was the basement. Because of the rats, Esteban Trueba had ordered the door bolted shut, but Alba would slip down through a skylight and land noiselessly in that paradise of long-forgotten objects. The place was always dark and protected from the ravages of time, like a sealed pyramid. There were piles of cast-off furniture, tools of mysterious utility, broken machinery, and pieces of covadonga, the prehistoric automobile that her uncles had taken apart and rebuilt into a racing car and that had ended its days as a heap of scrap iron. Alba used these things to build houses in the corners. There were trunks and suitcases filled with old clothes, which she used to stage her solitary plays, and a sad, dark, moth-eaten rug with the head of a dog, which when laid out on the floor resembled a wretched animal that had been split open. It was the last ignominious vestige of faithful Barrabás. One Christmas Eve, Clara gave her granddaughter a fabulous present that occasionally superseded the fascination of the basement. A box filled with jars of paint, brushes, a small ladder, and permission to use the biggest wall in her bedroom whenever she wanted. "This will give her an outlet for her feelings," Clara said, watching Alba balanced on the ladder, painting a train full of animals just below the ceiling. With the passage of time, Alba filled not only one, but all her bedroom walls with an immense fresco, in the midst of a Venusian flora and an impossible fauna of invented animals, much like those Rosa had embroidered on her tablecloth and Blanca baked in her kiln. She painted all the wishes, memories, sorrows, and joys of her childhood. Her two uncles were very close to her. Jaime was her favorite. He was a large, hairy man who shaved twice a day and still looked as if he had a four-day-old beard. He had black, evil-looking eyebrows that he combed upward to make his niece believe that he was in league with the devil, and hair stiff as a broom, which he slicked down to no avail, and which is always damp. He came and went with his books under his arm and a plumber's bag in his hand. He had told Alba that he worked as a jewelry thief, and that the dreadful bag contained his picklocks and brass knuckles. The child pretended to be frightened, but she knew her uncle was a doctor, and that the bag contained the tools of his profession. Together, they had invented certain imaginary games to entertain themselves on rainy afternoons. "Bring on the elephant," Uncle Jaime would command. Alba would go out and return pulling an imaginary pachyderm on an invisible rope. They could spend a good half hour giving him the herbs elephants like to eat, bathing his skin with mud to protect it from the harsh effects of bad weather, and polishing his ivory tusks while they heatedly discussed the advantages and disadvantages of living in the jungle. "This child is going to wind up stark raving mad," Senator Trueba would say whenever he saw little Alba sitting on the balcony reading the medical treatises her uncle Jaime lent her. She was the only person in the house who had the key to her uncle's tunnel of books, along with his permission to take them out and read them. Blanca argued that her reading should be monitored because there were certain things that were inappropriate for her age. But her uncle Jaime felt that people never read what did not interest them, and that if it interested them, that meant they were sufficiently mature to read it. He had the same theory about bathing and eating. He said that if the child did not want to take a bath, it was because she did not need to, and that she should be fed whatever she wanted whenever she was hungry, because the body knows its needs better than anyone. On this point, however, Blanca was inflexible, forcing her daughter to observe a strict schedule and the usual rules of hygiene. The upshot was that in addition to her normal baths and meals, Alba sucked the candies her uncle brought her and hosed herself down whenever she was hot, neither of these two activities having the slightest effect on her healthy constitution. Alba would have liked her uncle Jaime to marry her mother, because it was safer to have him as a father than an uncle. But it was explained to her that this sort of incestuous union produces mongoloid offspring. As a result, she imagined that the pupils at her mother's Thursday workshops were her uncle's children. Nicolás was also close to the little girl's heart, but there was something ephemeral and volatile about him. He was always in a hurry, always just passing through, as if he were jumping from one idea to another, and this made Alba uneasy. She was 5 years old when her uncle Nicolás returned from India, tired of invoking God through the three-legged table and a cloud of hashish. He had decided to seek him in a region less harsh than his native land. He spent 2 months harassing Clara, following her around the house and whispering in her ear while she was asleep, until he finally convinced her to sell a diamond ring to pay his way to the land of Mahatma Gandhi. This time, Esteban Trueba did not attempt to hold him back, because he thought a trip through that distant nation of starving people and nomadic cows would do his son a lot of good. "If you don't die of a snake bite or some foreign plague, I hope you return a man, because I'm fed up with all your eccentricities," his father told him when he said goodbye to him on the pier. Nicolás spent a year as a beggar, following the path of the yogis across the Himalayas, through Kathmandu, along the Ganges, and on to Benares, all on foot. By the end of his pilgrimage, he was convinced that God exists, and had learned to pierce his cheeks and chest with hatpins and to live practically without eating. The family saw him coming toward the house one ordinary morning with an infant's diaper covering his private parts, his skin clinging to his bones, and that lost gaze so often observed in those who eat only vegetables. He was escorted by two incredulous policemen who were ready to arrest him unless he could prove that he really was the son of Senator Trueba, and by a knot of children who were running along behind him, throwing garbage at him and laughing. Clara was the only one who had no difficulty recognizing him. His father reassured the policeman and ordered Nicolás to take a bath and put on some normal clothes if he wanted to stay in the house, but Nicolás stared at him without seeing and did not reply. He had become a vegetarian. He did not eat meat, milk, or eggs. His diet was the same as a rabbit's, and his anxious face gradually came to resemble the face of that animal. He chewed each mouthful of his sparse nourishment 50 times. Meals became an endless ritual, during which Alba fell asleep on her empty plate, and the servants dozed in the kitchen over their trays, while Nicolás solemnly chewed his food. Esteban Trueba stopped going to the house and took his meals at the club. Nicolás insisted he could walk barefoot on a bed of coals, but each time he announced a demonstration, Clara had an asthma attack, and he was forced to stop. He spoke in Asiatic parables that could not always be understood. His only interests were of a spiritual nature, the materialism of domestic life and the excessive ministrations of his mother and his sister, who insisted on feeding and dressing him, irritated him, as did Alba's fascinated pursuit. She followed him around the house like a puppy, begging him to show her how to stand on her head and stick pins through her skin. He remained naked even after winter set in. He could go 3 minutes without breathing, and was ready to demonstrate this accomplishment whenever anybody asked, which was quite often. Jaime said it was a shame that air was free, because according to his calculations, Nicolás breathed only half of what a normal person did, although this did not appear to affect him in the least. He spent the winter locked in his room eating carrots without complaining about the cold, and filling page after page with his minute handwriting in black ink. With the first signs of spring, he announced that his book was completed. He had 1,500 pages and managed to convince his father and brother Jaime to pay for it, against whatever profits its sale might bring. After being corrected and printed, the 1,500 pages reduced themselves to 600, yielding a voluminous treatise on the 99 names of God and formulas for attaining nirvana through respiratory exercise. The book was not the success he had hoped for, and boxes filled with copies wound up in the basement, where Alba used them as bricks to build her trenches, until the day, years later, when they were used to fuel an infamous bonfire. As soon as the book was off the presses, Nicolás cradled it lovingly in his arms, recovered his hyena smile, put on decent clothes, and announced that the time had come to bring the truth to those of his generation who remained shrouded in darkness. Esteban Trueba reminded him that he was not welcome to use the house as an academy, and warned him that he would not tolerate his putting pagan ideas into Alba's head, much less teaching her his fakir's tricks. Nicolás went off to preach at the cafeteria in the university, where he acquired an impressive number of followers for his classes in spiritual and respiratory exercise. He spent his free time riding his motorcycle and teaching his niece how to conquer pain and other weaknesses of the flesh. His method consisted of identifying whatever made her frightened. The child, who had a certain inclination for the macabre, would concentrate, according to her uncle's instructions, until she was able to visualize her mother's death as if it were really happening. She saw her chalk white and cold, her beautiful purple eyes shut, lying in her coffin. She heard the weeping of the family. She saw the silent procession of friends file in, leave their calling cards on a tray, and walk out with bowed heads. She smelled the flowers and heard the neighing of the plumed horses of the funeral carriage. She felt how her feet hurt in her new mourning shoes. She imagined her loneliness, her abandonment, her orphanhood. Her uncle helped her think of all these things without crying, and taught her to relax and not resist the pain so that it would pass through her without stopping. Other times, Alba would squeeze a finger in the door and learn to withstand the burning pain without complaint. If she managed to get through an entire week without crying, overcoming all the tests Nicolás imposed, she won a prize, which almost always consisted of a motorcycle ride at breakneck speed, an unforgettable experience. Once, they wound up in the middle of a herd of cows that were going toward the stable. Along a road on the edge of the city where Nicolás had taken his niece as her reward. She would always remember the heavy animals, their slowness, their filthy tails hitting her in the face, the smell of dung, the horns grazing her, and the terrible sensation of emptiness in her stomach, of fantastic vertigo, of incredible excitement, a mixture of passionate curiosity and terror that she only felt again in a few fleeting moments of her life. Esteban Trueba, who had always found it difficult